On Good Friday, and again this morning, we have seen Jesus' death and resurrection on trial. We've been reminded of the strength of the evidence for these epic events. It's important to begin there, that Jesus lived, died, and rose again, not as the figment of hopeful imaginations, but rather, as Luke says, quote, by many infallible proofs. Lee Strobel was a graduate of Yale Law School who went on to become a renowned investigative reporter and legal editor for the Chicago Tribune. After years of marriage, his wife stunned him when she converted to Christianity. He immediately plunged into an intensive investigation of Christianity, expecting it to confirm his skepticism. Instead, he himself surprised himself and ended up converting to Christianity, went on to become a well-known preacher, and ultimately wrote a best-selling book called The Case for Christ, where he pours over the evidence in and around the death and resurrection of Jesus, interviewing many leading scholars, pouring over both the minutiae of the evidence and the monumental points of evidence about Jesus' death and resurrection. For example, in one of the interviews with Dr. William Craig, Dr. Craig reminds us that first century Jewish culture was very misogynistic, to the point that women were considered incompetent. It wasn't unusual, unfortunately, in ancient cultures. In fact, there were rabbinic sayings circulating at the time that would say things like, let the words of the law be burned rather than being delivered to women. In fact, the misogyny ran so deep that in Jewish culture, women were not allowed to testify in their courts of law. A woman could witness a murder and not be allowed to testify to it. So in that environment, if you were a disciple of Jesus living in the first century, interested in concocting a legendary account of Jesus' resurrection in order to persuade others, the last thing on earth you would have chosen to do was to make Mary Magdalene the first eyewitness to the resurrection of Jesus Christ. The only reason you would say a woman in that culture was the first to witness the resurrection of Jesus is because you had to, because that's how it happened. In the law, there's a term for that. We call it an admission against interest. For a woman to be the first to see Jesus' resurrection in his culture at his time was not just a revolutionary act on Jesus' part. It was a classic admission against interest. Because you see, when somebody says something against their best interest, we have the highest confidence that they're telling the truth, because they would have no reason to say something against their best interest except they had to, because that's how it happened. It's evidentiary points like that embedded in the gospel accounts of Jesus' resurrection that give us high confidence in the historicity of those accounts. It's why in 2 Peter 1:16, the Apostle Peter says, can I get my slides going, please? Bingo. Oh, whoa, let me go backwards now. It's why the Apostle Peter said, we have not followed cunningly devised fables when we made known to you the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but we were eyewitnesses to his majesty. So, if all that's true, if Jesus actually lived, died, and rose from the dead, the question becomes, what does that mean for us? What does that mean for you and me in our everyday lives? Those are the questions I want us to wrestle with on this Easter Sunday, starting with a prayer. God, awaken each one of us today to a fuller appreciation of the significance of the resurrection of Jesus for us operationally on the ground where we live every day. May we experience and feel the power of the presence of the risen Christ in this place today. In his holy name we pray. Amen. My dad was in IU Hospital a couple months ago. Late one night after a long visit, I said, "Dad, I need to get going. I need to swing back by the church and then get home." As I was putting my coat on, Dad said to me, "Jeff, when you go out to get into your car in the parking lot, before you get in your car, be sure to check your back seat." It took me a half second to recognize what he was saying because it was so off the wall, but then it hit me. He was afraid that while I was in there visiting, somebody may have broken into my car, hid on the floor of the back seat, and was waiting for me to get back into the car to carjack me. I chuckled a little and said, "I'll be sure to check the back seat, Dad." Then he said to me, "Jeff, when you pull up to the church, before you get out of your vehicle, make sure there's nobody between you and the front door to the church." Again, it took me a half second, and then it hit me. He thinks that there might be somebody lurking in the shadows of the church, just waiting on the off chance that I might return to the church at 10 p.m. so they could attack me. "Okay, Dad," I said, "I'll keep my eyes peeled." Then he said to me, "Jeff, it's freezing out there today. There's probably going to be ice on the bridges. Drive slow." "Okay, Dad," I said, "I'll take it really slow." You see, my dad has always been like that. He's always lived like that. If we're sitting watching TV and a commercial comes on where somebody's rock climbing or skydiving, invariably he will say the same thing: "Not me, not in a million years." My mom was the same way. You see, I come from a family of very cautious people. Dad lives the existential equivalent of a prevent defense. If you're a football fan, you know what a prevent defense is. It's when it's near the end of the game and you're ahead and the other team has the ball and you can't let them score. And so instead of playing a normal defense where you would blitz and take other risks to try to stop them and get the ball back, you instead fall back and play a soft defense, deliberately allowing them to make small gains in hopes that the clock will run out before they can score. Dad lives the existential equivalent of a prevent defense. It's a dangerous world out there. Lots of risk. Be careful. Above all else, play it safe. I once heard about an elderly man who, on his deathbed, the last thing he said was, "Thank God I made it here safely." As if the highest goal in life is to be safe and achieve longevity. It's easy to fall into that trap in our lives, living a life of risk avoidance, sacrificing adventure, maximizing the chances of minimizing the risks of loss so that we can survive for as long as possible. Last Sunday night, I was having dinner with my dad at MCL Cafeteria, along with every other person in Indianapolis over 80 years of age. Apparently, it's the place to be seen if you're over 80 in Indianapolis. Having dinner with us were two friends of mine from the congregation, Andrea and Jennifer, and Andrea's elderly mother. During dinner, Andrea's mother told us about a time years ago when she traveled to Israel. Andrea asked me, "Jeff, have you ever been to Israel?" "No," I said. "Would you like to?" "Oh, yes," I said, but not until there's peace in the Middle East. Right now, it's just so unsafe there. And that's when I had my Geico moment. You know those Geico TV commercials where people suddenly realize, I'm becoming my parents. I mean, if the truth be told, I would love to go to Israel. I'd give my right arm to... Well, no, that would be too risky. But I would love to go to Israel, to walk where Jesus walked, to see what Jesus saw, to be in the places where the great stories of the Bible took place. It would easily be one of the top five most epic, awesome experiences in my life. But here I was telling Andrea that I was willing to trade off one of the top five adventurous experiences of my life so I could stay here in Indiana, where nothing ever happens. But at least you're safe. And I suspect that I'm not the only one living in a defensive crouch. I can't ask her out. What if she shoots me down? I can't leave my job. The pay, the benefits are too good. I hate it, but I can't leave it. I gotta hang on to all my money because you never know what might happen and when you'll need it. I can't come out to my family. What if they reject me? I can't adopt another dog. I'll fall in love and then she'll die and she'll break my heart. I just can't go through that again. I can't leave my abusive husband. How would I survive? And on the list goes. And where it ends, nobody knows. All the things that we do and don't do to play it safe in life. But then along comes today's gospel passage. The scene described in Matthew chapter 16 took place months, maybe even years, before the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus. So it may seem like an odd passage for us to be talking about on Easter Sunday. We're talking about this passage, though, because this is the point at which the Easter story began. But for what happened in Matthew chapter 16, there would have been no Easter story. So let's connect the dots. The scene that is described in Matthew chapter 16 has Jesus in private conversation with his disciples when out of the blue, Jesus asks, Matthew 16:13, who do people say the Son of Man is? The disciples responded, as you heard read earlier, some people say you're the reincarnation of John the Baptist or Elijah or one of the other great prophets. Who do you say I am? Simon Peter spoke up and said in the words of verse 16, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. Moved by what Peter said, Jesus went on to reply to him in verse 18, you are Petros. That was Jesus' nickname for Simon, derived from the Aramaic word that means rock. So Jesus says, you are Petros, and on this Petra, on this rock, I will build my church. The underlying word for church there is ecclesia, meaning an assembly of people, a people movement. So Jesus is saying, on this rock, I will build my movement, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. In other words, Jesus is saying, on faith like that which Peter was exhibiting, on that rock-like faith, he was going to build a people movement that would be so great, it would storm the gates of hell. It was going to be awesome. And while rhapsodizing in this vision of the possibilities of what was to come, notice what Jesus says next. Verse 21. From that time on, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and undergo great suffering and be killed and on the third day be raised. Verse 22. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, God forbid it, Lord. This must never happen to you. If it's going to be dangerous in Jerusalem, then we just won't go there. We'll stay right here in Galilee, doing the same thing we've been doing, in the same place we've been doing it. Yes, Lord, you may not impact as many lives, but at least you will have a nice long life. And we'll be safe. Verse 23. But Jesus turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me. Peter, you mean well, but you're in the way of God's purposes. If any want to become my followers, Jesus said, let them deny themselves, take up their cross, and follow me to Jerusalem. And from that point forward, we're told, Jesus began to say to his disciples over and over and over again, I am going to Jerusalem, even if it costs me my life. because Jesus understood that for his movement to take off, if his movement was going to reach its potential and be able to spread across the Roman Empire, first it had to get to the big city, to Jerusalem. You see, Jerusalem was the capital of that region, located in the south of Israel. Everything was happening in Jerusalem. It was an ancient crossroads. If you could make it in Jerusalem, you could make it anywhere. Galilee, where Jesus was, by contrast, was the outback. It was flyover country. It was the rural north of Israel. So Peter is saying to Jesus, no, let's stay here. Let's play it safe. Let's be where we are, Jesus. And Jesus understands that he can't. That if his ministry can reach Jerusalem and ignite there, there would be no stopping it. So you see, the risk was worth the reward. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. Jesus might die there, but that was God's problem. Jesus' responsibility was to do what he was called to do. And by so doing, Jesus was showing us the way. The path to Easter miracles in our own life. Take up your cross and follow me. Jesus was calling us to go to Jerusalem. Lord, no, it's too dangerous there in Jerusalem. I don't care, Jesus says. I'm called and I will go. Damn the torpedoes and full speed ahead. That was Jesus' attitude. And you see, Easter, it's an attitude. It's an attitude that says, I'm going to Jerusalem. A defiant attitude that says, I don't care. I've got to do what I'm called to do. And so Jesus was going to go boldly. He wasn't going to live in a defensive crouch. And he calls us to live with that same bravado, with that same sense of adventure. Because the road to Easter runs through Jerusalem. Jerusalem represents danger. Risk and opportunity. So tell me, in your life right now, what does Jerusalem represent? Something you feel called to, but you're scared. And you're tempted to play it safe. You will never rise to new life. You will never become all you were meant to be. You will never get your Easter miracle unless, like Jesus, you face the danger. Take up your cross and follow. Let me show you a short video. In this video, you'll see a teenager walking on crutches, and you'll see his faithful dog following. Keep an eye on the dog. You see what this puppy dog is doing, right? If his beloved master was hobbled, then he wanted to be hobbled. If his beloved master was walking with a limp, then he wanted to mirror that and also walk with a limp. It's what discipleship is supposed to look like. It's what Jesus meant when he said, follow me. It's what Jesus meant when he said in Luke 6:40, a disciple who is fully qualified will be like the teacher. So, if Jesus was called to go to Jerusalem, that means each one of us in our life, in our own unique way, are also going to be called to Jerusalem. And it's dangerous in Jerusalem. You could fail. You could even get killed, literally or figuratively. But what's the alternative? Suppose Jesus had acceded to Peter's advice to stay in Galilee and to play it safe there. Jesus could have lived a lot longer, but would he have been any happier? Ultimately, would his life have had any more meaning or impact? Jesus knew he didn't have to cling to life. He knew that if he died, God would raise him up from the dead again. So Jesus could afford to take some chances. Jesus could afford to be bold. It's what Jesus meant when he said in John 11:25, "The one who believes in me will live, even though he dies. And whoever lives and believes in me will never die." Do you see what that means? It means if I want to live well, I can't be afraid to die, literally or figuratively. And I don't need to be afraid to die, because the same God who raised Jesus up from the dead will raise me up from the dead, which means I can afford to take some chances. I can afford to be bold. For us as Christians, failure and death is never the last word. So don't be afraid of your Jerusalem. March into it boldly with fanfare like Jesus on Palm Sunday. Don't play it safe. Take life by the horns. A year ago, in March, the University of Virginia men's basketball team went into the NCAA tournament, the number one seed among 64 teams. That means overall, they were ranked number one among 64 different teams. As such, in their first game in the tournament, in their bracket as the number one seed, they were entitled to play the 16th seed, the lowest, or I should say the last seed, the weakest team, which happened to be an unknown school called the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, UMBC. In the entire history of NCAA men's basketball, no 16th seed had ever defeated a first seed. So this was going to be an easy win for the University of Virginia, except something happened along the way, and UMBC ended up defeating them by 20 points. First time in the history of basketball a 16th seed had upset a number one seed in the NCAA men's division. It was a humiliating defeat. It was basketball death. In fact, some of the crazed University of Virginia fans made death threats against the players to the point that the players had to have police protection. These players knew that for the rest of their lives, they were now going to be known as the ones who made basketball history as the biggest losers of all time. I'm sure they just wanted to crawl in a hole and die. But their coach, Tony Bennett, who's a devout follower of Jesus, drawing on his faith background, insisted that his players reframe what had happened to them, because for we who follow Jesus, failure and death is never the last word. So Tony Bennett taught his players to refer to their ignominious loss as the painful gift. Whenever they talked about the game, they referred to it as the painful gift, reframing it in terms of if we respond to this with the right spirit, if instead of giving up and crawling in a hole and dying, we are willing to boldly keep forging forward, learn from it, face our Jerusalem, we will come back stronger than ever. In fact, at UVA, they have a team motto that says, "In the end, the faithful prevail." The players bought into that. Instead of giving up, came back the next year. Had a great season, ended up being a number one seed in the NCAA tournament again. Matched against a 16th seed. Imagine how unnerving that first game must have been against that 16th seed. Are we cursed? Is it going to happen again? But they won that game. Kept winning games. When they got to the Elite Eight, remember, they, if you're a basketball fan, they played Purdue. And it took a miraculous last-second escape for them to defeat Purdue. In fact, in all the basketball I've ever seen, I don't think I've ever seen a comeback quite as miraculous as the last few seconds of the UVA-Purdue game, even though I was rooting for Purdue. And then in the Final Four, it took a freaky last-second series of events for the University of Virginia to defeat Auburn. And then in the championship game, it went into overtime. All these near-death experiences. But guess who ended up winning the championship? The University of Virginia. In a year's time, they went from the biggest losers in the history of basketball to the champions of the world, all because they weren't going to curl up in a ball and die. They took what they had experienced, their failure, their basketball death experience, they took it as a painful gift from which they could learn and from which they could come back stronger than ever. That's the spirit of Easter. That's the attitude of Easter. We cannot get from Matthew 16, safe, ordinary life in Galilee, to Matthew 28, the extraordinary experience of resurrection, without first passing through Jerusalem. What does Jerusalem represent in your life today? It's dangerous out there. I remember a time years ago when I was a young lawyer in Washington, D.C., and each morning I would get up, get dressed, and head out of my apartment, walk 7 minutes to the subway, and then take the subway into my office. So one beautiful spring, sunny morning, I get up, get dressed, put on my suit, put on my tie, and I'm headed toward the subway. About halfway walking to the subway, suddenly and without warning, I lost my sight in my right eye. I mean, suddenly, I could not see anything out of my right eye. Instinctively, I put my hand up to my eye, and I felt a strange, gooey substance that looked white with a little brown in it. I took off my glasses and saw my right lens on the inside was completely coated in this white goo. And that's when it hit me. Oh my gosh, what are the odds? What are the odds that a bird was flying over at just the right moment, took a dump at just the right moment, and I happened to be walking in just the right place for it to land precisely on the inside of my glasses lens and splatter on my face.
Good job.
When my sisters and I were kids, we learned a little limerick. You may have learned it too. Birdie, birdie in the sky, why you do that in my eye? Gee, I'm glad cows don't fly. I was living that limerick. I raced back to my apartment and I showered. And I showered again and I showered again. And I didn't want to come out of my apartment. It's dangerous out there. But Jesus calls us to follow him into danger. To not live a life of risk avoidance, but a life of embracing adventure and the possibilities of God. Let me close with this. If you've been around here a while, you know that one of my heroes in life is someone from our congregation named Robin Herman. Many of you know Robin's story, but there's a new chapter in her story. For those who are new, the backstory is that almost 20 years ago, one day, Robin scheduled an appointment, came in to talk to me. She was at the time a young manager in the corporate structure of the McDonald's Corporation, making a good salary, great benefits, a great career path in front of her. She sat down and she said, "You know, I think maybe God is calling me to leave it all behind and take the risk of starting a small business." She felt called to start a doggy daycare, not just because God had put her together in such a way that she loves spending time with dogs, but she saw how she could leverage that facility to go down to the pound, rescue dogs off of death row, bring them back to her facility, socialize them, and then adopt them out. To jump into this venture, she was going to have to pledge her house as collateral to the bank. It was risky. Leaving her career, pledging her house, she decided to take the plunge. Since then, she's had a thriving business. And she has taken out of the pound and adopted out more than 1,000 dogs. Robin was here in early service today. In any event, the rest of the story, the new chapter in the story, is that about 6 months ago, Robin scheduled another appointment with me. Came in, sat down. She explained that the building that her business has been in, a building she's acquired over time, had a long-term tenant that leased about 2/3 of it. So she was in 1/3 of the building and this tenant in 2/3 of the building. But that lease was coming due, and that meant she'd have the opportunity not to renew the lease, which would allow her to triple the size of her business. But to do that, she'd have to take out a $1.3 million loan. She and Lisa would have to pledge their home again. And she'd have to quickly grow her business to have the cash flow to pay back that $1.3 million loan. She explained all this to me and said, "So what do you think?" The first question I asked her was, imagine you don't do it. And fast forward went to when you're 80 years old and are looking back. How will you feel? That settled it for her. Because she knew she could do more for dogs in need if she had a bigger facility. She knew she would have the space in that building to have an area dedicated to elderly dogs that she pulls off the pound, out of the pound, the most difficult to adopt out. And they could even live out their life there if nobody wanted to adopt them. She decided, she'll tell you, I can't not do this. So she and Lisa signed the collateral on their house, signed the loan. They're now midway through construction of the facility. This is Robin standing in front of the counter here, and this is the plaque that hangs in her office in the facility with God. All things are possible. Now, Robin could fail. It's possible she could lose everything. But it's worth the risk to give some elderly dogs a shot at their Easter miracle. Robin is modeling for us what it means to follow Jesus to Jerusalem. This past week, I made a decision as I was working on this sermon. Didn't even have time to tell David until the first service. The decision I made this week is, sometime in the next 10 years, whether there's peace in the Middle East or not, we are going to Jerusalem. And I hope you will go with me. Whatever Jerusalem represents for you, because that is the spirit of Easter. Don't